people and talking to him about is that I had gotten a little tired of paroling, and the support for on the outs wasn't there as far as I could see. And that was several years ago, is that I kind of got tired of, we pulled them out, and then they would get out, and the youth would call on the phone and say, hey, I was supposed to have some support out here, dealing with trying to locate a job, locate a housing, what have you. They didn't have that. But, again, going back to the director and some of the things that he wants done and that he tells people what should be done, that is changing. That has changed. Now we have the support on the street. We have the support in the community. Dealing with jobs, dealing with housing, dealing with health, dealing with mental health issues, dealing with making sure the medication goes. We got a program now is that you just can't leave OIA if you're on medication and go out on the street. You will have a supply of meds sent with you to wherever you're going, and then they work on making sure that can't force you to take it, but the opportunity for you to get your medication and stay on it is there. Those are some of the things that the community is working in. And many things that we do at McLaren bring the community into the organization, into the institution, and work with the community in dealing with some of the people who are going to get out very soon so that they can have some of the support. And some can't go back to their families, so they have to go someplace else. And that's being worked on. It's not like we used to do it, goodbye at the front door and go, catch the bus, give them his bus ticket. It's not that way anymore. With your help, things are changing. So it's not that.
Well, I recognize that, and I also recognize that the business community has a large part to play, and that's the reason I raised that issue, to make certain that jobs are available. It's you know, you can do all of the work that you need to do, but there has to be a link between the institution, the bridge back to the community, and the business community and the community at large, if we're going to make this work.
Could I just let you know then, Senator, and give you a little bit of background on that real quickly, is that...
If you can make it real quickly.
It's going to be very quick. Is that, as far as the bridge back, is that we have people who are taking up professionals, welding, a restaurant, all the things that you speak of, it's out there, and we're doing it, and they are getting the jobs. And a couple of guys make more money than I do. So, I mean, they're out there, and they're getting the support. Thank you, sir.
Morales House's program also does a lot of transitioning. They got girls working in demolition crews, going in and working in houses, painting, different tasks also in construction. So,
real quick, before you go, Representative Nathanson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a comment on the kind of testimony we've just heard. This is really excellent testimonies. We sometimes, with all due respect to the wonderful staff and department heads and administrators that are out there who've talked to us, often what we get is a very bureaucratic view of this is what the agency does and here's the numbers. And this testimony where you've told us what you're doing, what you're accomplishing, yet you also somehow melded it in to performance measurement, which is one of those real big kind of like government speak and bureaucratic gobbledygook, but you told us exactly how you are addressing, whether it's in your own interest as a taxpayer or as a very caring, humane staff person, how you are achieving better results and how that relates to budgeting and how it relates to the whole state and how we make improvements in an individual life, but also in the impact it has on the budget and on the community. So this is one of the clearest presentations I've heard like that, and I want to thank you for it.
Thanks.
We appreciate it, Senator. Representative.
We appreciate you coming.
Thanks.
Thank you. All right, next up, I'll invite back Director Jester.
Kimmy'd like that too.
Want the suit coat? I'm already going to run for the Senate or something.
Director Jester and Mrs. Rios.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester.
Bob, before you go on, is it Ms. Rios or Dr. Rios?
Ms. Rios.
Okay.
We refer to her as Dr. Rios, but...
I just wanted to make sure I was properly respectful with you.
For the record, my name is Bob Jester. I'm the bureaucratic director of the Oregon Youth Authority. Very hard to follow that kind of testimony, and yesterday I can tell you that when we returned to the office, we were all, I think, rightfully humbled by the public testimony. And when we have representatives from labor come and tell that kind of story, I think it speaks to the staff of the Oregon Youth Authority, much less to the people that run it, but to the people that do the work every day. So I very much appreciate their testimony and the testimony of partners and stakeholders from yesterday. We are picking up in your book on page 23. We are talking about the key performance measurements for the Oregon Youth Authority. And just to bring us up to speed, we have related the key performance measurements to the four parts of the Oregon Youth Authority mission. And we are talking about the mission of public safety. We spoke on Tuesday about recidivism. KPM 12 and 13, which are displayed on page 23, are the recap of that. Excuse me, I'm on the wrong page. On page 25, we will start. This is the measurement of youth who have escaped or walked away from our secure facilities and transition programs during the period of a fiscal year. And the measurement includes our transition work reentry programs, where we actually have work crews and young people that are working in communities and are not behind fences and are not secured and have access to walk away from those crews. As you will see, we are recommending that the new wording of this KPM be changed to number of escapes per fiscal year. It has been per calendar year. The actual for fiscal year 06 is 8. The target is 12. And the challenge that we have in this particular measurement, where we think that we will be doing significantly better, is if we get the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility and are able to establish a gender-specific program for young women, this will have an impact on the effectiveness of our transition program at Corvallis House by coupling these two programs together. Young women have a higher flight pattern than young men do, and so far this year, for example, in 07, we have had 9 walkaways, and 7 of those are young women. So we know that the close custody population has 9% young women, although we have about 80% of the walkaways are young women. So the focusing on gender-specific programs, the gender-specific transition, we believe will have a very positive end effect on this key performance measurement.
Thank you. I have a question just about the way you're representing the statistics. Speaking of bureaucrats and charts and numbers, I love that stuff too. you're using real numbers rather than representing a ratio, you know, a percentage of something. Is there a reason? Because 9 out of 90 is quite different than 9 out of 9,000. Is there a reason you chose to use absolute numbers instead of a percentage of the population? Of your population, that is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matheson, last time we presented ratios and we were asked to present numbers.
Oh, yes.
In our document, in our report, we have both ratios and numbers because you raise a very good point in terms of seeing the proportion over time, but the ratio was so small it was hard to understand the numbers that actually.
Well, thank you. I'm sure that the people who've gone before me are much wiser.
No.
On page 26, we have the same measurement for our community, and these are the number of runaways from provider supervision, including youth that may be on home visits or out of the actual supervision and placement of that provider for a short period of time for reentry. And we are not proposing any changes in this KPM. You will see that in 06, the actual was 305. The target is 280. This is a duplicated number, by the way. We have some youth that are running more than once, and each episode is counted. And I think that you heard yesterday from our provider community that OYA relies on for services provided that the high turnover rate, I believe it was cited that almost 50% in one program has a turnover rate in the staff that deal with young people, and now this is moving into their supervisory ranks at these programs. Although I think they have excellent programs, they do a great job, their turnover is high, and this is very disruptive to youth. And so youth often leave when these attachments are broken, when staff move on. We are hoping that the package that will address the provider rates will have a positive and significant impact on this KPM. On page 20.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Talking about staff, I had heard today some place about the turmoil that's going on there.
Could you pass the mic over?
Okay. Potentially, Senate Bill 400 will have some effect upon the negotiation may lower your staff. Is there any truth to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I believe that Senate Bill 400 relates to state staff. I'm not sure that it relates to staff in the private sector that we contract with.
Just so I mean, do you, how much of your staff...
On this policy bill.
I mean, I'm just thinking this is a budget bill. If it does actually affect this budget, the statement you just made was, well, we need more staff. And arguments in 400 are that, well, if this happens, then potentially, at least from the cities and counties' viewpoint, that they think they're telling us they're going to have to lower their staffing level. Will that affect Bergen Youth Authority staffing level for state employees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I'm missing the question here.
I assume you're not familiar with
the Senate bill. It didn't affect it 10 years ago when they had that same right. So,
okay. Why don't we move on?
Somebody just told me that, particularly the state employees. I just was trying to make that connection.
It will.
We'll assume it doesn't affect OYA.
Well, department.
It will on DLC.
Yeah. Please continue.
Okay. I apologize. We can get information on that to you as it is relevant for us. And these programs, again, are community-based programs, and we're at least referring now to the private sector and their staffing levels and their inability at the current reimbursement rate to retain their staff, because in many cases they're paying minimum wage to those individuals.
Mr. Chair, I give the Senator Winters correct, who says it probably will affect DLC, Department of Corrections. So I just made a faulty... See, representing Nathanson there. I'm not.
fair.
There's still hope for you.
The next KPM on page 27 relates to the accountability part of our mission, and that is the amount of restitution paid during a fiscal year. And previously, we have reported on the amount that is paid as a point in time and a dollar amount. And during the last legislative session, we talked about the fact that this did not have a particular relevance because it was as compared to what. We are now recommending that this be reported as a percentage of restitution that is paid when the order for custody to the Oregon Youth Authority is closed. We believe this is a more relevant and meaningful number. And actually, the 06 data is presented 25% of the restitution that was ordered was paid at the time that the case was closed. A couple of comments to make. One is that the courts have adopted a strategy where civil judgments are ordered for youth who are leaving the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority so that the obligation of the payment of this restitution continues and does not end just because the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority has been terminated. On page 29, we get into the KPMs on reformation. And this, I think, is directly related to the presentation that folks heard from Dr. Latessa. What you see on page 29 is a chart that shows the focus on the key components that we measure which impact recidivism, which starts with the risk assessment, the case plan, the provision for the interventions, moving to the transition to the community, and that rests on the engagement in work or school. There are five KPMs that are relevant to reformation. The first of those are youth that receive a risk need assessment within 30 days of commitment or admission to the Oregon Youth Authority. This is a standardized risk assessment instrument that Dr. Latessa spoke of. This is a new endeavor for the Oregon Youth Authority to ensure that every youth that comes into our custody is given a risk need assessment so that we can appropriately define what their individual criminogenic risk factors are, and we can align those with specific programs to reduce the risk both in terms of reoffending and lower their needs. In 06, there were 47% were done within 30 days. You will see a significant increase in the target to 80. We have taken some very proactive steps in the Youth Authority to increase the ability for our staff to get these done. One is that we've centralized intake in one location. That's currently Hillcrest. And in the community, our probation staff have been working diligently after additional training to do the risk need assessment for youth that are coming into our custody for the purpose of probation supervision on the front end. On page 31, you will see the KPM number 7. That is a correctional treatment KPM, which is a percentage of youth committed to the Oregon Youth Authority for more than 30 days whose records indicate active domains in the case plan as identified by the risk assessment. This, in layperson's terms, as it has been taught to me, this shows that we have taken the risk need assessment, we've developed an action plan for each youth offender that is actually coming off of what their risks and needs are, and that that is in place. As you will see in 06, there were 41% of these that were accomplished within 30 days. We believe the 30 days is not a realistic time frame to activate these domains, and if you have 30 days to complete the risk need assessment, we believe we need an additional 30 days to actually activate the case plan, and we are recommending a change to 60 days with that. In 07, our target is 80% and up from there to 100% to be accomplished within 60 days. KPM 8, which we had a great deal of discussion about during our last session, has to do with educational services provided to youth within 60 days of their OIA case plan. So if the case plan indicates that there is a need for special education, you know, what is the percentage of youth that are actually receiving that specified educational plan within that time period? In 06, the actual was 81%. You see that we go up to 85. This year, 90, 95 with a goal of 103 years. In transition planning, this area was one that was emphasized by Dr. Latessa. You can do the best work, as we've heard from youth that are in facilities and the kinds of programs that they access. We have controls on them. They're not running away. We have their attention. But it's when they transition back to the community that's a critical part for whether they're going to be successful. So this KPM addresses the number of youth that are released from custody during the fiscal year who are receiving transition services per, again, that OIA case plan that are targeting their criminogenic risk factors. In 06, we have 10%, which is actually a result of the case plan not being automated on our JAJA system, our inability to track and record that appropriately. In 07, you see that the target is 80% and going out to 100% from there. We are recommending that this be changed from fiscal year, excuse me, from calendar year to fiscal year to be consistent with our other measurements. KPM 12 measures youth that are engaged in school or work in the community within 30 days of their release and or placement on probation. In 06, this was 85%, which we believe was a number that was overreported. And we have set what we believe are realistic targets for this KPM, and it is 60, 65, and 70% going out to 100%. Safe environments on page 35. You know, this has to do not only with the safety of Oregonians and communities, but the safety of our staff who you've heard testify before you and the safety of the youth that you've met before you in public testimony. We have three KPMs related to this value of the Oregon Youth Authority. One is suicidal behavior, staff to youth injuries, and youth to youth injuries. In suicidal behavior, the goal is zero. In fiscal year 06, we had 12 attempts, which are behaviors that were serious enough for us to record as ones that could have resulted in the loss of life by a youth. This is a combined field and facility. KPM, although the numbers and the charts in the bottom, you'll see the difference between the field and facilities. The target ramps down, the goal being zero, but understanding that youth that are in custody with the mental health profile that we have discussed with this committee, it is realistic for us to assume that there will be some behaviors that we need to continue to stay vigilant and on top of, with the goal again being zero. KPM number four is staff to youth injuries. The Oregon Youth Authority has a zero tolerance for staff to youth injuries, for any intentional injury to a youth from a staff person. However, in a close custody environment where you have staff intervening physically with youth to keep them safe, there are sometimes injuries to youth that result from that. When you look at the measurements, we have in 06, we reported zero. We have actually broadened the net for the definition, and we believe in 07 we will get to 4, 3, 2 accordingly going out. In the field, we continue to set the target as being zero injuries.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question. With a zero, which is a really high standard, a good standard, does that mean that your workers' comp rate is at zero, too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, these would be injuries that youth have as a result of staff, and our youth are covered by workers' comp in work situations. And so this would be an injury that would be, say, a staff that was intervening in a two youth that were fighting, and by holding on to one of the youth, they got injured. That would be a not a workers' comp claim on the part of the youth. So it would not have a bearing on workers' comp. On page 38, KPM number 3 measures youth seriously injured by another youth in Oregon Youth Authority custody, both field and facilities. Again, our tolerance for injuries of youth is zero. The reality is that when you have youth in a facility and there's various activities from sports to group living going on in open dormitories, there are injuries. We, again, goal is zero. You'll see the targets, both field and facility. There is a important difference made between the targets with the facility concentration of youth and the field. Field, we have 2, and we're starting at the facilities at 20 and working down from there. On page 39, we have the customer service KPMs. And this is the percentage of customers rating their overall satisfaction with the agency as being above average or excellent. And the first time out, we did the customer satisfaction survey. We used a citizen review board, which you may recall is an arm of the judicial department, reviews youth who have been in substitute care placements for 6 months or longer, and the agency goes before that group of lay citizens who have been trained, and we actually provide updates and information about how the youth is doing, what the plan is, and they have the ability to ask questions and follow up on information. We thought this was a good customer base for our first year. On the left-hand side dark bar chart, you will see the outcome of that first year customer service survey with Citizen Review Board, and the Youth Authority is above 80% in every area except the availability of information. There always is discussion around what kinds of information, particularly HIPAA-protected documents, that can be shared with citizens. We have started in July of this year using families and youth offenders at the point of termination for that same customer survey. We do not have data on that, but you'll see that our target is 75% for being above average or excellent, and we will be reporting on that during the next legislative session.
Mr. Jester, can I ask you a question? Sorry if I got distracted on something that I had to pay attention to here. So if you already answered this, I apologize. The the customer satisfaction, you know, one thing that I've seen working with trying to help adults transition from penal institutions is that sometimes families have to travel very long time distances to get for the meeting, and perhaps if there's a, you know, occasionally a mess up at the front desk, the name's not there, maybe they're wearing a wire bra and they, you know, for whatever reason they can't get through. It would seem that one way that we could monitor customer satisfaction would be to just send a survey to the families. Has that ever been considered?
Mr. Chair, we are sending surveys to families.
So to all families?
Correct.
Right.
Yes. And actually, upon entrance to the authority, we'll talk about this a little bit more during our wrap-up and the follow-up to the Youth Safety Committee recommendations. The families of youth that enter the Oregon Youth Authority are truly inundated with not only surveys but information, 1-800 toll-free complaint line that is handled independently from our various divisions within the Youth Authority. And we have really tried to be as transparent and open to families and parents and providers and stakeholders as we can be.
Would you mind getting to the professional staff, kind of the appeal process for complaints or and the 800 number? Because occasionally if we get a constituent who complains about something, we can direct them.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. On Monday, we will have that information as part of our wrap-up, and we'll show you the posters and also what families get and also the cards that youth and families get. We actually give them a business card with a 1-800 number on it.
Wonderful. Senator Brown.
Thanks. Actually, it's more a substantive question than a ways and means one, but I'm just curious, having had some experience with the Citizens Review Board, does the court then review the findings of the CRB? How does that process work in the OIA system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we have a separate agreement with the CRB from that of DHS. The process is the same. The court would review the information. The way the reviews are done are a little bit different.
Okay.
And we can speak about that in more depth in the community presentation. Ms. Andahl, that we'll be presenting, actually has worked on both negotiating and monitoring that agreement with
okay.
the CRBs for
Great.
Us.
That's fine. Thank you.
On page 41, there is a summary of the Oregon Youth Authority Governor's recommended budget. You will see that the total recommended funds are approximately $317 million, 39% of those going to community services, and 47% of those going to facility services. I want to point out that the importance of this is a shift in those dollars, and that I believe that the governor has been very thoughtful in trying to get back in balance a system that was out of whack from the community reductions that we took during the recession of 2001-03. In the bottom, you'll see the support areas and the portions of budget that we will be talking about more definitively as we go through. The split of the budget of the $317 million, 83% are general fund. We are obviously a heavily general funded agency. 10% are federal funds, and the 7% other funds are primarily from child support that are collected. The policy option packages, which are displayed on page 42, we will be going through individually in the appropriate sections and talking about the key performance measurements and how those relate and will enhance them. So I'd be happy to answer any questions on the overview or KPMs.
Representative Cameron. Thank you. Thanks, Bob. And I wanted to make a follow-up statement to open your presentation and thank your staff and gave them all the credit, but I just remember a favorite line about from a movie about attitude reflects leadership. So thanks for your leadership in the organization. Real quick question. When you referred to other funds in child support, sometimes I just want to clarify, is that from the parents of the children that are in the system? And how is that derived at?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, that is exactly where it comes from. And it is based on the cost that the state incurs by having youth of families in either out-of-home care placement, foster care, residential care, and or our youth correctional facilities. and parents are billed the actual cost of care, and then there is a negotiation that occurs from that point forward in terms of their ability to reasonably pay and offset the cost to the state taxpayers for that residential care.
Just follow me. So that 7% obviously then would represent only a very small fraction of the people that are in the system, the youth that are in the system, have parents that you can go back and collect those costs from? Is that so small?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, it would reflect the portion of funds that we receive overall. So some families may pay $10 a month. Some families may pay $100 a month. Some families may pay $400 a month. And Department of Justice Support Enforcement Division actually is the agency that works with families to set that amount.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hanna.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Director Jester, I asked this question when we reviewed Department of Corrections, but because OIA seemingly is able to go and be paid back to some degree for some of the work they've done by families through the child support collection, how would it work for families whose child is in the facilities or in the program who are covered by the family's health insurance to be reimbursed for health services that you provide?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, there we use them first. So any health costs would be billed to the family first, and what the family health insurance did not cover, the state would then pick up.
Follow-up? Yes, follow-up.
Will we get into any detail of that during that discussion? I mean, do you know what percentage of your health costs have been reimbursed by insurance?
Representative Shields, Representative Hanna, we certainly can get there before we have that discussion. We'll get some numbers for you.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to introduce Karen Andahl, who is the interim assistant administrator responsible for our community services program.
Yeah, that would be fine. I want to make sure that the folks from Multnomah County have a chance to testify. I'll leave that up to you if you'd like to bring them forward first so that we make sure that we hear their...
Thank you, Chair Shields. I'm actually, it's their request that they do that now, so that's fine with me.
Yeah, let's do that.
Thank you.
Chief Peluso, Sergeant Williams, and Dave Koch.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of committee. My name is Carla Peluso. I am honored to be the Gresham Police Chief. And we are here today to report on funds we received via the Oregon Youth Authority, or from you to them to us, to establish the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team, a regional team that services East Multnomah County that includes the City of Gresham, City of Troutdale, City of Fairview, and the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. And I've asked Sergeant Williams to join me today, who is the sergeant in charge of that unit, and we are very happy to report back a tremendous year of work and effort that has allowed us to stabilize a situation, but certainly the job is not done. But a tremendous amount of activity and progress has been made in a year's period of time that has at least gotten the attention of those involved in gang behavior and gang criminal activity as we work to combat that situation on a daily basis. So it is my pleasure to introduce Sergeant Pat Williams.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Again, my name is Patrick Williams, City of Gresham Police Sergeant, Chair Shields, and members of the panel. Thanks for having us. As the Chief said, we're comprised of a variety of agencies. I'll cover some of the issues that we've facing in East Multnomah County. since the inception of this team, we've started to recognize and be able to combat the gang issues that we're dealing with on a daily basis. And if we go back to June of 2005, we've had a significant increase in the number of shootings and stabbings in our city and the regional area that surrounds us, and that goes all the way out into Clackamas County, where there is an increase of female gang activity in addition to the male gangs. Predominantly, we're dealing with mostly Hispanic, Southern California gangs that have migrated north up through the Pacific Northwest. Also with that, as I said, the female gang shootings have went up, and the gang-related crime with females have increased. Back in 2005 of June, we've had female gang members shot by other gang associates. February of 2006, a female was shot accidentally by a 19-year-old gang member. We had very, very little support from the members involved in that crime. So the case ended up being suspended. However, we were able to learn of a rape that occurred from the victim of that shooting. In May of 2006, we had gang members arrive at an apartment complex that I was personally involved in, where they ended up taking some shots at some people standing out in front. When officers arrived, we found very uncooperative people. We had found shell casings out in the parking lot. Suspects had left, but we had to deal with 19 people inside an apartment complex, a two-bedroom apartment, that were absolutely hostile to us and refused us to give us any information to help with that investigation. Again, in May of 2006, we had a shooting victim that arrived in a Portland hospital that wouldn't cooperate with the City of Portland officers. They learned through their investigation that led to a Gresham case, and of course we were called in. Again, no cooperation. I can go down a whole list of things that we have in our statistics, and one after another show that our lack of cooperation from the victims and the suspects involved in these cases. Very few times do we gain their cooperation. And what that's led us to do is take on a number of other investigative tactics to try and help solve these crimes. If we go down just in the gang-related stabbings from the summer of last year, we've had to suspend at least one of the cases because of the lack of cooperation from many of the people involved. We've made a number of other arrests involving stabbings. And one in particular happened in October of last year, where a person was stabbed on a street corner. When officers arrived, first things out of his mouth were, "I didn't call for the police. I'll take care of this myself. Leave me alone." He was put in an ambulance. He was fighting with the officers the entire time, trying to give information. Within a week, that same individual came back with a group of his gang members to a complex to find out who the person was that stabbed him. Two innocent people standing out in front of their home working on their car were pistol whipped by this individual and his associates. That led my gang team to solve that crime within virtually an hour of that case happening. We were able to take that person into custody, find a shell casing that was involved in the pistol whipping. After he pistol whipped somebody, he shot some rounds off. After he was arrested, he took reports that came from our investigation and actually gleaned some victim information out of it, found out exactly where these individuals lived in the complex that he had threatened and pistol whipped, went back, and he set the apartment a portion of the complex on fire. So not only was he indicted on charges a week prior of the pistol whipping and unlawful use of a firearm, he was now indicted on several counts of attempted murder in that complex. In November and December, within 30 days, we had two homicides involving gang activity. Again, very, very little cooperation from anybody involved. And, in fact, it came to the point where victims or actually witnesses of these crimes were coerced by people's members of the community not to testify against them. And so these folks were in fear of retaliation. And I was one of the individuals that spent an entire day tracking people down just to try to get them to grand jury to testify that they actually saw a car pull up in front of a location before a person was stabbed in the head with a screwdriver. And these are crimes that are occurring in our neighborhood, in our region of the metropolitan area that we have just not seen for years and years and years, and everybody is suffering from it. Not only are we seeing an increase in the Hispanic gangs, we're also seeing an increase in the number of white supremacist-type groups that are forming in the East Multnomah County area. One of those in particular is a European Kindred, which started in the Oregon State prison system, and it's grown and branched out to the streets. And one of those things that those guys have learned from the prison system is that they meet each other in the prisons, yet when they go back home to their communities, they're from all over the state. And so that gang has really spread out statewide and has become one of the most prolific gangs in our state, and it will continue to grow. And one of our officers, Multnomah County Sheriff's Deputy, has been tracking these guys for 2 years now, and we are very successful in a number of cases that we've done on these people. In fact, I can't tell you how many guns we've taken from these folks. I can't elaborate about the investigation, but it's been ongoing for over 2 years now, and we continue to work on it. We participate in a number of gang-related training throughout the metropolitan area for other local law enforcement. We've done training in Central Oregon. We've done training down in Southern Oregon. We continue to provide training at our own respective agencies. One of the other things that we've done with this money is we've made it a very concerted effort to get our community service specialists that work within our department to publish flyers and get out to the community to try and help provide some gang outreach. One of the things that I've done since I've come into the unit is made a very concerted effort to get into our schools and try and help educate the staff and the faculty as to what we're seeing out there and how they can help themselves and be a little bit more prepared to combat some of the problems. Because the gang members, what used to be a sacred area inside these schools is no longer a sacred area. They're actually bringing their gang activity into the schools, which is causing a considerable amount of time and effort on behalf of the staff, just trying to deal with the dress code issues and the weapons-related problems. I have a number of statistics that I could go into where I can say from working gang enforcement back in the early 1990s when the gangs were coming up from Southern California, what we are seeing now in East Multnomah County as a result of the housing that is improving in North and Northeast Portland, which is getting shoved to the surrounding areas, and Gresham has taken a significant amount of crime-related issues as a result of that. With those related issues, some of the statistics, if I can go through the number of street gangs that we initially identified at the beginning of our gang enforcement. We were only able to identify as little as 20 different sets of gangs that were operating in our city in East Multnomah County. Now we have documented 126 gang sets that are out in our area. Continually every year we document more and more gang members. We're into about 600 to 700 gang members that are officially documented just in our area alone. But statistically, we believe that is probably doubled. Because we can't identify all these actual gang members and their associates. One of the things that we were able to find is that there's been about a 33% increase in criminal street gang-related contacts. There's been 30% decrease in gang members documented, but that's because we are better able to identify these people, and we're not just contacting the same people over and over. We've had an increase of weapons seized from gang members, and that is 137%. We have an increase in felony arrests from 2005 to 2006 of 46%. We have an increase in misdemeanor arrests of 3%, and increase of cases that are referred to the district attorney's office have from 2005 to 2006 has increased 28%. At this time, would any of you like any questions? Or
Senator Burdick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the increase in weapons taken away from kids. Several years ago, we passed a measure in Oregon. It was actually my measure to require background checks as gun shows. And one of the pieces of data that we had was from the Portland Police Bureau. They did a detailed analysis of where the gang members were getting, or where juveniles were getting their guns. And quite a number of the largest percentage were coming from gun shows because background checks weren't required. Now we're requiring background checks, and yet they're still getting a hold of guns. Are you doing any kind of detailed analysis on where all these guns are coming from?
Chair Shields and Senator Burdick, we with this grant, that's one of the things that we weren't required to document, so we don't have a real good way to show how these are coming out. I can tell you from experience out on the street, and a good example is a case last night. About 3 weeks ago, we had a young man who was a gang member in our area that committed suicide. And there was allegations that it wasn't an actual suicide, that somebody actually killed him, because when he shot himself, he was high on methamphetamine. He was in southeast Portland when it happened. Shot himself in the head. Within seconds, his pockets were stripped of any money and any drugs that he had, and the gun was taken from him, which led officers that arrived on scene to believe that it was a homicide. That gun has been out on the street now for 2 weeks. We just now caught it in somebody's hands last night from an individual who ran from us at a female gang fight. When he ran across the street during the pursuit from the officer, he dropped the gun. That gun, we have no way to track where it came from. A good majority of these guns are purchased at gun shows, but there are also a number of them that are stolen in home burglaries and just regular thefts. And so,
follow up, Mr. Chair. You say they're purchased at gun shows, but background checks are required at gun shows now. So either it isn't working, or either they're not complying, or these people are somehow legally getting them at gun shows.
Chair Shields and Senator Burdick, what's happening is we trace them as far as we can based on the serial numbers and the information that is available to us. Oftentimes, again, they are a product of a burglary. Oftentimes, the serial number has been diluted, and we're unable to make those tracings. There are systems available to us that allow us to trace kind of the types of weapons based on similarities, but it is very difficult to actually trace it back to the original owner. And our belief is the vast majority are stolen from even outside of our state. But we do make attempts at every time we seize a weapon, and we work very closely with the U.S. attorney to try and pursue past the state lines as well.
And final follow-up,
Last
Chair,
thing,
do you also use the state InstaCheck system?
Yes, we do.
Check that.
Yes, we do.
Resource?
And it's a very helpful resource. We just, especially with this population, we don't have a lot of luck, because I think they're coming from a wide variety of locations, even far beyond our borders.
Thank you. Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. If I recall, when the special appropriations was granted to East Multnomah County, that the discussion then was that we knew that gangs were on the increase, but if I recall, the conversation was that the dollars were to be how to reduce the gang activity. And I've heard you talk today about all of the various increases and what's going on. What's your strategy to reduce? Because that was the purpose of the appropriation. I think we did several special appropriations.
Sure. Chair Shields and Senator Winters, I'm glad you asked that. One of the things that we have done and made a very significant impact on our ability to investigate gang-related crime is that we have an established program already in place that we didn't have prior to this funding. And what we are doing now is we are able to make a very concerted effort to go after these guys, because we have a unit that's comprised of officers that have been doing this now for an extended period of time. They've learned the gang members. They learn the extended family. They know where they run to. They know where they hide. And so when we go to investigate these, we're a lot more efficient at doing so. I think that we have made a significant impact on the amount of crime. In fact, this came from a gang member's mouth just to me about 2 weeks ago when we were doing a surveillance, and we found him with a gun. He's now being prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. He told me, the word is, we don't go near Gresham because we know you guys are going to be on us. And so that shows me that the word is out on the streets, that these guys know that we are a very effective entity at investigating these crimes, and even with the lack of support, we're still able to succeed.
Are you keeping enough statistics that if you came back to this body to ask this body for additional funding, that we would say yes, that you are doing a reduction and be able to honor that request?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, any time additional resources are thrown towards the investigation and the contact of a specific element of crime, we fully expect in year one that our statistics show you activity. it's truly a we expect to see a spike, and that's what we've seen. We can provide you numbers of contacts, of crimes, of documented gang members, guns seized. We have to have a little time then to show a reduction, because really what we're doing is we increase the enforcement efforts, we're locating them. So can we come back in a couple of weeks and those sorts of things? We can show you the reduction, I think, based on more what the schools are telling us, what our community is telling us they feel, but hardcore along the line facts, I'm not going to lie to you and tell you we can.
I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and say there's maybe one more question, then we're going to need to keep going.
Thank you. Sergeant, you were talking about trouble with witnesses. There's a bill to open some grand jury testimony after a case. Do you think that would help or hinder you if witnesses knew that their grand jury testimony might be made public?
Chair Shields, Representative Barker, I don't know if it would or wouldn't, to be honest with you. I think it's a case-by-case basis. I wish I had a real good answer for you.
I must say you've done a very good job of sidestepping various landmines we've been putting out there for you. tough issues, that's all, that a lot of us are working on and grappling with here. Important ones, though, and we appreciate the question. Any other testimony you'd like to leave us with?
No, again, just we appreciate the time today, and we very much appreciate the funding and hopefully an opportunity to carry on some very good work.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your help and service. Sheila.
Mr. Chair, I just point out to members in the appendices of your presentation document under tab 7, there's some written material from the East Metro Gang Enforcement Team, and then under tab 8, there is a report on the effectiveness and distribution of services for the other Multnomah County funding as well. So that's some additional information in terms of outcomes.
All right. Who's next? Okay. Community services. Okay. Sorry, Dave, not on the agenda.
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, it's good to be back. I'm David Cook, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I'm just going to highlight some of the items that you'll find in that report just to tell you what we're doing with that funding. Like Chief Peluso, DCJ very much appreciates the support and certainly the funding in our efforts to impact and reduce gang violence and gang activity in Multnomah County. Julian here brought along, and he was kind enough to join me, to join an aging bureaucrat in a long ride down from Portland. So I'll have Julian speak in a few minutes. As you know, Gang Transition Services support culturally specific intervention activities with gang-involved youth who are on probation in Multnomah County. This is an appropriation that comes from the legislature directly to Multnomah County through OYA. And I want to acknowledge the support of Senators Carter and Gordley for their both ongoing support, and they really champion the efforts to preserve these services and the funding. The program really originated in response, and the funding did, to a community outcry about gang violence in North Portland back in the 90s, and it has continued. It was developed by the community. The request was made by the community, and the funding came to the county to address those problems. What have we done with this money? In the 18-month period, from July 2005 through December 2006, we've had about 172 youth who have been through it and in GTS services. Of those youth, nearly 70% have not reoffended while they've been involved in the program, and they have not reoffended 6 months after. We have more data in the report if you'd like to look at that. Also of significance is that over 80% of youth involved in GTS-funded services have not been committed to the Oregon Youth Authority. I say that, and I think it's significant, because that has a direct impact on minority overrepresentation in the juvenile justice system. Typically, youth who are committed from Multnomah County tend to be youth of color. and by impacting them in the community, working with them effectively, and keeping them from commitment to OYA, we are impacting overrepresentation, but we're also impacting in a positive way their lives and the community. The results are also significant because these youth, and especially gang-involved youth, are those who represent the 8% population. You may have heard of those. The 8% population in most probation agencies account for over 50% of criminal referrals. And so by impacting that population, reducing recidivism, reducing commitment to OYA, we're giving you a good return on the investment. I'm glad Chief Peluso was able to talk about her program, what they're doing in East County. We partner very closely with Chief Peluso, the East County Task Force, and also with the City of Portland Police Bureau Chief Sizer in working to intervene and interdict in gang activity and involvement. The partnership between DCJ and community-based organizations is really significant in that over 50% of the dollars that come to Multnomah County from the GTS funds go to community-based providers. These providers are delivering culturally specific, developmentally, and gender-appropriate services to youth in our community. Some of these programs are Self-Enhancement, Inc., Latino Network, Victory Outreach, Maple Star, Native American Youth Association, and Asian Family Centers. There are gang-involved youth, you know, all different races and ethnic groups, and these programs are able to intervene with those youth, with their families, in the communities in which they reside. And that has a big impact. These are in addition to treatment services that the department provides that are also culturally specific in terms of residential alcohol and drug, multisystemic therapy, and then probation supervision. I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I'd like to have Julian introduce himself, talk a little bit about his experience.
My name is Julian Nazario. I came on short notice. I came from work. I'm really happy for what Babe and his organization has done to help me. In my past, I was a known gang member, active in...
Could you take the mic a little bit closer?
Active in gang violence, the gang community. Since I've been part of the probation program, I've gone through outpatient drug treatment. I lived in a Maple Star home for 3 months. I've gotten back in school, gotten a job. I just graduated last month, and now I'm applying for Western Oregon University to major in education.
So there's a little bit of story as far as, and I do appreciate Julian on very short notice coming. He left work immediately, and this might indicate what kind of work he's in. But he might like to tell you a little bit about that.
When I was more involved in the gang community, I was known to do a lot of graffiti. And it's kind of ironic that what I do now is remove it for the county.
World works in strange symbiotic ways. Yes. They can ask you a question, Dan.
Yes.
Could you get us a breakdown of where the money went for this, $1 million and some odd outlay? How much went to the Gresham Police? How much went to the various community-based organizations?
Chair Shields, I'd be happy to. The funding that goes to the Gresham Police Department is a separate allocation. And we can provide that information and also that which comes directly to Department of Community Justice and how we allocate those resources. I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. Representative.
No, there was another one. Another
Julian, would you be open to a question?
Read your
Since you came through this program, what's the largest barrier to you staying there? I mean, what potentially gets in the way of you staying away from the gang activity and in school and at work and that kind of thing?
Really, my largest barrier was having too much free time.
Right.
So I worked with them to get a job, get back into school, to keep my time used up so that I wouldn't have the urge to go out and do criminal things. So pretty much if I stay busy, I stay out of trouble.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Thank you. And Ms. Andel,
you can
start. Now, colleagues, before you go, I just wanted to let you know that for the first time, I think, all year, all of us were here. So that was quite a touching moment, I thought. We should have gotten a picture.
I don't know about the
Sandal, ready when you are.
Hello. Chair Shields, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking with you about community services within the Oregon Youth Authority. My name is Karen Andel. I'm interim assistant director for field services for the Youth Authority. My presentation begins on page 44 of your binder. Just briefly, it's important to note that the purpose of community services within the Oregon Youth Authority is to provide case management of youth offenders focused on the goal of protecting the public by reducing the risk of future criminal activity. This case management includes supervision by parole and probation officers, which is supported by a continuum of sanctions and services out in the community. You'll note on the top pie chart on page 44 that approximately 39% of Youth Authority budget is targeted at community services. And if you'll note down below, the largest proportion of the budget is dedicated to residential and foster care. With second in that is parole and probation services. We also provide youth gang services, as you've heard, diversion programs, and juvenile crime funding. Page 45 discusses the population served within community services. We directly serve within this portion of the budget youth offenders between the ages of 12 and 25, each of which have been adjudicated by a juvenile court and who were placed in the legal custody of our agency for parole or probation services, and they are granted the ability to live in the community under this custody arrangement. Indirectly, as Mr. Jester has mentioned, and you've heard from the juvenile department directors, Oregon Youth Authority is very interested in assisting counties to reduce statewide juvenile recidivism. And through the funding that we provide to counties, they're able to provide prevention programs that hopefully keep youth offenders from coming into their or further penetrating their systems, as well as from coming to the Youth Authority custody. Some of the characteristics of youth in our community programs are that more than twice as many females, approximately 16%, are served in our community programs versus the numbers in close custody. Mr. Florip will discuss that with you during his facility section. About two-thirds of youth offenders served in our community programs are under the age of 18, and about half of the offenders in these community programs have been committed to our custody for property offenses. You'll note below, we have approximately 28 of our community youth who are youth of color, and there are about 28% who are in our legal custody for sexual offenses living in the community. As an overview of the services that we provide through community services, we provide public safety, youth accountability, and reformation services to youth offenders. We carry this out through many partnerships with our local juvenile departments, with our providers, and other stakeholders. There are four major components of community services. We have parole and probation, residential and youth foster care, individualized community services, and then our diversion, juvenile crime basic services, and youth gang services. Moving on to page 47, parole and probation services. These services include case management for the youth offender placed in our custody and supervision. There are approximately 1,700 youth who receive these services and supervision committed by juvenile courts in any one given time. We carry this out through dedicated and professional parole and probation officers and the staff that who work with them to supervise and monitor compliance with court order conditions and our OA rules and regulations. But a huge portion of what our folks do is to properly assess the risk to reoffend of these youth offenders and the needs that they have to support them to be able to remain in the community. And based on that risk and need level, establish individualized case plans that incorporate all of the services and requirements for those youth and hopefully working with their families in that process so that they can successfully remain in the community and not reoffend. As you probably know, we also coordinate and monitor restitution, community service, and victim-specific activities. And again, working with juvenile departments very closely to ensure that we're coordinating the work that we're doing and the services that are being provided and the dollars out in our communities. We actually have 36 co-management agreements with county juvenile departments that clearly articulate the roles and responsibilities of the OA staff and the county staff, and they work together to arrange for the fundings that are spent at the local level. The second component of community services is residential and foster care. Our residential and foster care services are provided to youth offenders who cannot actually remain in their own homes in the community, nor can they live independently based on the risk to reoffend and the services that they need. And these programs provide behavioral structure and treatment as well as other supports so that they can gain the ability to live independently or to return to their homes. We contract with approximately 30 residential treatment providers, some of which you heard from yesterday during the public testimony. And these programs provide professional, very structured environments for youth to live in, and they then provide the supportive services such as independent living, preparation, a myriad of treatment services, sex offender, mental health, drug and alcohol treatment. They provide ability for youth to have educational, vocational experiences, lots of skill building and counseling and ongoing assessment evaluation. And they work with our probation officers to keep these individual case plans and the risk and needs assessment linked during the time of the case in their programs. I think some of you probably are aware that Behavioral Rehabilitation Services, or BRS, which is a Medicaid program, helps support the funding of the services that are provided through our providers. Youth offender foster care, as you might guess, these are structured family living environments, and this is a step down in terms of structured placement for youth in our custody out in the community. You've probably talked to foster parents in the past. These are very dedicated folks living out in communities who are very committed to youth and who live in their homes. We have really raised the bar. We've really placed high expectations on the standards for our foster care system. We've audited our program. We've done continuous review, and we feel like in the last few years we've made great strides to improve and restructure our foster care system. Some of the areas that we've worked with are our actual certification and recruitment processes, helping to receive that our folks receive better training, having certifiers work closely with to support the foster parents, and to work with our probation officers who have the youth in those homes.
Can I ask you a question about that?
Certainly.
With multi-systemic therapy, functional family therapy, a lot of and multi-dimensional treatment, foster care, those are considered kind of the cream of the crop when it comes to treatment, and something like $15 to one, if I recall. But what Dr. Letessa said, and I think this is what you're alluding to, so I just wanted to get some assurances that the program has fidelity and it's actually being implemented in the way that it was designed to be implemented. I mean, I know when I was doing cognitive behavioral therapy with offenders, as soon as that became the vogue, everybody's job readiness program was then cognitive in nature because it was the... what assurances can you give us that that training is happening, that certain people who are... Is MTFC actually trademarked by somebody that comes in and tests for fidelity of the program?
Mr. Chair, all the programs that we contract with have undergone the CPC, so the correctional checklist they have done, and we do actually measure for fidelity. And our training of foster parents, we do not actually have individual family foster parents that are providing FFT or MST. It's all contracted. So those are individually reviewed.
Okay. Can I ask a question?
Yes, Senator Winters.
When I was with Children's Services a lot of years ago, when you were there, we had professional foster care. Do we still have professional foster families, which is different than what I think some understand when we talk foster families?
Chair Shields, Senator Winters, yes, we do. And actually, the current term of art is proctor care. Much of our proctor care and our proctor homes are provided through residential providers or our private providers who then certify and work with those homes. We actually assist in the certification, but the supervision is provided mainly through those provider systems.
And our follow-up,
please.
Our compensation is different. Is it different?
Representative Shields, Senator Winters, yes, it is. Thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, thank you.
I'd like to direct you to page 49, where you'll see a map that gives you an idea by showing where all of the residential providers are located around the state. And, for example, you'll note St. Mary's Home for Boys in Beaverton. We have in Marion County, Salem Area Street Visions, there are Youth Progress and Morrison Center in the Portland metro area. We have programs in Pendleton, such as Youth Homestead Youth Lodge and Stepping Stone, Looking Glass, and Lane County area. So they're spread around the state very well.
Just a question, Representative Wilkinson.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on something that was sparked by a comment from Senator Winters. It has to do with provider rates. As far as you know, out of all of these residential treatment programs, are they all surviving all right? Are we possibly facing a situation where we won't have services to provide?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, thank you for that question. And we'll be speaking in some more depth to that when I talk about the policy option package. We've not had, I think we have great concern for our providers. And as you heard some of that based on their comments yesterday, they've been steadfast and very committed to continuing the relationship with the Youth Authority. But we do know and we do recognize and do experience the issues that they are facing in terms of being able to provide stability in their staff to be able to manage the youth that we place in their care. And we see that through some of the issues that we have with youth, such as runaway recidivism, injuries in the programs. We also have witnessed that in terms of merely when we are in a position to solicit RFPs, their inability to be able to come to the table and to offer to even, you know, propose to those programs. So I think we're in a difficult situation, and, you know, we're very supportive of being able to support them better.
Representative Shield, Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, just to add to that answer, we have twice now gone out for RFPs, a request for proposals, one for sex offender beds and the other for treatment and assessment capacity, and both of those have gone unmet by providers because the rate of which we're offering to pay is not a rate which they can provide the service. And so we have some unused capacity that we have not been able to get providers to take because of that rate. So it is we're at a critical point in terms of that.
Wow, that is very telling when you can't give the money away.
The third component I'd like to address is individualized community services. You know, we have youth offenders in these various programs in the community, some in their homes, some living independently, but it's frequent that these youth offenders have some specific and supplemental needs that aren't addressed specifically through the programs and for which there is not funding available through the programming in the community or through insurance or other ways for them to receive it. And so this is where individualized services comes in. As I mentioned earlier, each youth has a risk need assessment and a corresponding individual case plan. So when a need arises for the youth to have a supplemental service, it has to be directly targeted toward the plan, and that is the means by which it's authorized for payment. So the probation officer, parole officer, wherever the youth is living, the provider, the parent, the family, and others come together in the juvenile department, for example, and they determine whether it's appropriate to actually fund the service that's being requested, and then it's very specifically outlined in the contract. So this is a great way for us to individualize the treatment areas and some supplemental services for youth offenders. Diversion, juvenile crime prevention, and youth gang services is the fourth component. You've heard from the local county juvenile departments and from our Multnomah gang folks. Youth Authority is extremely interested in reducing statewide juvenile crime, in helping our community partners do that, as well as it affects our ability and our, you know, our recidivism measures and our ability to work with youth in our system. So we have provided assistance to counties through diversion, juvenile crime prevention basic, and gang services so that specifically counties can reduce the youth's recidivism within their county programs and systems, and also that they can work with the highest risk youth to come to the Youth Authority and try to provide services to prevent them from coming to our custody system. That's where those dollars are actually targeted.
I think at this point we're at the 4:30 mark. Are you done on page 51 or
about
50 till 56?
Did you complete your thought on page 51?
Yes, sir.
I think if it's okay, I've been taking the committee longer than I had wanted to in the past. I'd like to let them out today at 4:30. Mm-hmm. If we could come back then, just continue on Monday, and we'll try to accelerate, see how far we get. Monday was to be the last day, correct? If you wouldn't mind.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I note that Monday we will likely get to the capital budget section of this budget, and it's a fairly large policy option package, including COP funded construction and maintenance. There's some general information about those projects, and I don't know with professional staff or the agency ahead of time if we could get a little more detailed breakout of the projects, more than what I'm seeing here, just in terms of if you show a number of the projects but not a specific dollar amount to each one.
Yeah, Representative Hanna has been doing great work with the Department of Corrections budget, just going through and helping them prioritize. I think that level of detail would be beneficial if you can provide it. Senator Brown.
Thank you. Ms. Andahl has been participating on our Oregon Law Commission's juvenile code rewrite for at least 4 years, I think, at this point, and just been a really great participant, and I just really appreciate your willingness to be there and be a forceful advocate for your issues. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And if I could also suggest, if Representative Hanna has it in his schedule, that you might want to try to get together with him for 15 minutes before the hearing for the Bureau does that. Just to walk him through some of those projects.
Chair Shields would be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you. Anything else we need to order? Speaking of adjourned. Thank you.